WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is Ray Davies, the lead singer and songwriter of The Kinks. They were one of the English bands that crossed the ocean during the British invasion of the 60s and are one of the few that endured through the decades. The Kinks have been inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Their early hits included such sexually driven songs as You Really Got Me, All Day and All of the Night, and Tired of Waiting for You, songs that later influenced the new wave bands of the next generation. After those early records, Davies started writing songs that were social satires of the times, like Well-Respected Man and Dedicated Follower of Fashion. Now at the age of 51, Davies has written an autobiography called X-Ray. He's also performing in several American cities. Tonight he performs in Philadelphia. Before we meet Ray Davies, let's listen to a song, Dedicated Follower of Fashion.
They seek him here, they seek him there. His clothes are loud, but never square. It will make or break him, so he's got to buy the best, 'cause he's a dedicated follower of fashion. And when he does his little rounds round the boutiques of London town, eagerly pursuing all the latest fads and trends, 'cause he's a dedicated follower of fashion. Oh yes he is,
oh yes he is,
oh yes he is,
oh yes he is.
Thinks he is a flower to be looked at, and when he pulls his frilly nylon and his raked up tight, he feels a dedicated follower of fashion.
I asked Ray Davies to take us back to the early days of the Kinks. The band started performing under the name The Ravens.
It was my brother's band. He was 13 years old. I'd left and gone to college, and I didn't really see Dave. In fact, I didn't live with my brother when we were growing up. I come from a large family, and I explain this in my book, in the sense that I had five sisters, much older, and so much older that... I grew until I was 5 years old. I called my eldest sister mother, so it's very confusing, especially for my mother. But coming from that background, so I didn't really have that the standard brother relationship with Dave, and I left home and went to college and came back, and there was this incredible, stunning guitarist who knew all these sort of choppy lyrics, lyrical guitar phrases. And he was much better than I was. So I was suddenly reduced to... I wanted to be sort of a jazz guitarist, blues guitarist. I was reduced to being the rhythm guitarist in The Ravens. And Dave was out there in front strutting around and doing his sort of... I don't know, his thing. It was an odd little band, really. Because, you know, we were sort of kids, really.
Were you writing songs for it?
Nope. I didn't. We were a covers band. Well, covers, doing things like Smokestack Lightning by and John Lee Hooker songs and Howling Wolf, Smokestack Lightning, and all those sort of laudable, you know, earthy, profound blues songs. And it was only later on that we got into Chuck Berry songs. But Chuck Berry was a big influence to me as a lyricist, obviously, later on when I started writing songs. But I had no aspirations to write songs then. I just wanted to play and do well.
Now, how did you start writing then?
I'd written poetry, and I think when we tried to get a record contract, the publishers were giving us songs that were similar to hits of the day, like She Loves You and Beatles songs, and I thought, well, there's no possibility of us actually doing as well as those people, so why not write our own songs? And I started writing seriously, I suppose. I'd only tinkered with it in the past, you know, writing instrumentals. I would write guitar solos to play in the band, because as I said, I wanted to be sort of more of an instrumentalist rather than a lyricist. And the lyrics really, when I started writing, it was like an outlet of all these, I guess, young frustrations, you know, normal teenage torment. And I found it very therapeutic. And I've always had insomnia, so I actually found something, and it, before, slightly before the days of all-night television, so I found something I could do all night.
Rhyme.
Yes, sitting there and with rhyming couplets. Yeah.
Now, tell the story of how the band got the name The Kinks.
Yeah, well, The Kinks were in a pub after rehearsal, and Dave, my brother, and Pete, who was the bass player at the time, wore these capes and leather capes and high boots. And I guess for the early, mid-60s, that was quite outrageous. And Kinky Boots, I think, was a single that it was a program called The Avengers had out. It was a TV show. And this guy standing at the bar, sort of, you know, nonchalantly looking over, half drunk, looking at us and saying, "You blokes who call yourselves The Kinks, because you look like them." I just didn't know quite what to say to this man. And then a man called Larry Page was standing with us, who became one of our managers. He said, "You know, you've got a point there. He's got the point, that guy. You should call yourselves The Kinks." The good thing about The Kinks is that it did leave an impression with people, whether it was good or bad. It was a short, punchy, one-syllable word. And we were on the bottom of a bill with other artists. And our name was the smallest, so it had to be just a few letters. So it seemed to, you know, foot the bill or fit the bill in every respect. And it was a name that really people remembered.
So did you have to visually play up the idea of Kinky?
I've always hated the name The Kinks. It's just, I think it's a daft name.
Mm-hmm.
And but I can't think of anything else to call us now except The Kinks. It's just, it's evolved. It's got our own meaning. Yes, it has kinkiness and whatever. But I think those connotations are not quite... I think The Kinks mean, in the true sense, maybe the edges or the wrinkles in society that maybe shouldn't be straightened out. And it's always opposed to walking the straight line always, because life isn't just a straight line.
Ray Davies is my guest, and he has a new autobiography called X-Ray.
It's actually the unofficial autobiography.
Unauthorized.
That's right.
Now, the first hit that you had was with your song, "You Really Got Me." And you write in your book that this was considered too risky to record. What were the problems?
Well, it was it wasn't, I suppose, wholesome enough to be, for the time, something that would be palatable for radio. And now it sounds really innocent, and people say, "Well, what's wrong with the lyric?" But for then, you've got to understand, it's a time when people still, although the Beatles were supposed to be a rough and ready outfit and the Rolling Stones were, there was still an element of polish about what everybody did. And the Kinks were a rough and ready outfit, there's no question about it. And so the record company eventually relented and let us record it, and to get our character, and that record really epitomises a lot of the way we feel that the fuzzy, raw sound that Dave worked so hard to get is really the way the band sounded. And that's, I think, why it was a success.
Well, it's such a great record. Why don't we hear it? And this is The Kinks, "You Really Got Me." My guest is Ray Davies, and he has a new unauthorized autobiography called X-Ray. Now, what were you thinking about when you wrote the song?
Not a lot, really. It's not a lot.
How did the line come to you?
I'd written a song a few years. As I said, I tried to write instrumental phrases, and I'd been writing those a few years earlier. And there was this repetitive phrase, da 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 da, you know, and going into strange accents and things. And I just probably sat there. We just had dinner at home, I went into the front room of the parlour where we had the piano, the little upright piano, and I started thumping this idea I'd thought of a few years earlier. And the words just came out. I think the subconscious was composing. It was not thought out.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the trick. It just the words evolved with the notes and they match. And looking at the lyric, if I'd brought the lyric to, you know, to somebody and said, write music to that, they'd probably tell me to get out, you know, because it's not very, doesn't look very inspiring. It's like all these things, when you put the two pieces together, lyric and music, it adds up to something in a strange way.
Now, you said that in your book that someone in your management said, well, I don't know whether you're singing to a boy or a girl, so you better put a girl's name in there somewhere.
That's right, yeah. Well, he was concerned about my about what, you know, who I was singing to and what my audience was. And I'm thankful in a sense that he suggested that I make it, I personalize it, because although I didn't use a name at the end, I thought girl would be appropriate. And but just thinking about that change probably gave me the, I know it sounds, it's not pretentious, but maybe it is, a psychological, maybe my voice, the way I sang it sounded different. I sang the thing like I knew roughly where it was directed. And so although I didn't use Susan or Barbara or whatever, Barbara, you really got me going, I sang girl, and I had an image of somebody there.
Mm-hmm. Now, you say in your book that you managed to keep the R&B feel even though making a pop record.
Mm.
And I think, yeah, that's really true. And also you write that you made a conscious effort to make your voice sound pure and to sing clearly, which I think is really interesting, considering that kind of really like fuzzy, aggressive guitar sound, and you're trying to sing, you know, purely and clearly. It's a really interesting contrast.
Yeah, I think it's like the old line, Noel Coward line, you know, remember the lines and speak clearly. We had made You Really Got Me once before, and we'd gone in with the producers and everything, and I'd been on tour, and my voice was a bit croaky, a bit like it is now, and it's like, yeah, You Really Got Me going. It's like really down there. So I remember that when we came to do the vocal, and we only had 3 hours to do it, so there was I, like, with 10 minutes to go, and it had to be right. So I thought, I took my voice up a bit, and again, thought I was higher, singing in a higher register than I was. And so emotionally, I was up there in the mid-frequencies, even though my voice was quite gravelly.
Yeah, because your voice got more pure and clear in later records, I think, don't you?
Yeah, I think so, yeah. The diction kicked in, the diction factor.
Right, which was never a big thing in rock and roll.
No, no, but again, our agents, who did come from another era, it was that sort of transition from, I don't know, theatre, I guess. They always said, sing, I know it's blues, but you must be heard.
Well, they sent in someone named Hal Carter. Was that his real name?
Hal, yes. Well, he told me it was his real name.
Okay. So he was sent in to work on your stage act. Mm. Why did they think you needed professional help with your stage act?
Well, we all need professional help from time to time. Maybe we needed it more than other people. As I said, we were a scruffy lot.
Uh-huh.
And musically confused, and I suppose immature. And because our first record had flopped, you know, it was an abysmal flop.
This was not You Got Me.
It wasn't You Really Got Me. We put out another single, which was a cover. It flopped. It was somebody else's song. And they thought, well, this band have got to do something, because they're on the tour now with all these other bands, and they must appear to be better than what they are. And I think they sent Hal along to structure our show a bit.
So what kind of advice did he give you?
He told me how to stand, and my brother, I remember he used to tell Dave to rave on his own in the corner, which I'm not quite sure what he meant by that, but jump up and down, and how to take a bow, all that stuff.
How should you take a bow?
Well, normally I sort of bend down and curtsy.
Did he have you bowing as if you were doing Shakespeare or something?
Is that sort of how to
singing in a Vegas
stage,
club?
And we used to listen to him, and then we used to go on stage and do exactly what we wanted to do in the first place. It was wonderful. He did give us, I'm sure some of it stuck with us, but it was just, I think it was fear that we might not cut it, I suppose. And they were concerned that we were not to fail. But you see, the trick is, with the Kinks, was that we could only be the way we were. And when we found that magic combination of the sound we had, which was, I think, quite original, and the look, the combination worked, and that's why that also helped, really got me to become a success.
What was the look?
Well, they found, we went to see this wonderful man called Monty Berman. He used to do, used to be the costume designer in lots of, well, mediocre British movies in the 50s, I think, and 60s. And by this time, in the mid-60s, he was a, you know, a costume, he had a big industry, you know, just renting out costumes. And he found these riding red riding jackets. And he combined those with sort of Regency-style frilly shirts, yellow frilly shirts, and strange boots and black trousers. And suddenly we walked on stage and we looked like the Kinks, whatever that is.
My guest is Ray Davies of the Kinks. He has a new autobiography called X-Ray. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Ray Davies is my guest, and he has a new autobiography called X-Ray. Let's play another song, another one that you wrote. Let's do Tired of Waiting for You, another early hit. Anything you can say about writing it?
That's from the original bunch I wrote, instrumentals, 2 years before. There is an interesting story, because we just had this huge hit with You Really Got Me at number one, and we were doing our first album, and they said, ah, we found a new writer, you know, it was me, and I was supposed to come up with all this material, but I didn't tell anybody, I didn't actually have anything except a few chords, and we went in and did the backtrack to that one morning, and they said, well, put the words, we used to put the vocal down at the same time, and I said, well, I've got a sore throat this morning, can I just do the backtrack first, the instruments first, and then I'll do the vocal later. Because I hadn't written the lyrics, you know, and we did the backtrack, and afterwards I said, well, I really feel I'm coming down with something, flu or something. So I couldn't sing that day, and I went home and just, you know, went out that night and came in the next morning. I made the words up on the spot, really. And it is one of those, another one of those repetitive lyrics, but somehow it works, because even though I didn't think, again, I don't want to keep labouring the point, but I thought that I wasn't writing. I was taking in ideas, and although they weren't going down on notepads or, you know, written, they were inside my head. They just came out. It's your life and you can do what you want. And basically I was telling myself, you know, I'm on this journey now, I've had this hit record, and it really is up to me what I write. So it was an interesting combination of being a bit of a con artist, telling them I had written something when I hadn't, and letting my emotions, my subconscious take over and do the work for me. It's very easy, really.
So you were fooling them, but you fooled them into thinking that you could do something that you actually found out you could do.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So, okay, let's hear Tired of Waiting for You, the Kinks from the mid-60s. My guest is Ray Davies.
Till I met you, but you keeping me waiting all of the time. What can I do? It's your life, and you can do what you want. Do what you like, but please don't keep me waiting.
My guest is Ray Davies, and he's written a new autobiography called X-Ray. Well, now, you were talking before about the guy who was brought in to help you improve the stage act. But at the same time, you say that the Kinks just stirred up an atmosphere of violence.
Yeah.
What was it about them? Was it something that happened on stage or off stage that you think was behind that?
I think inevitably the violence, the music, has a knock-on effect to what goes on off stage.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also to do with being, you know, very young doing this thing. I suppose we were the first or second generation of new musicians making a career out of rock music in England. And nobody taught us how to do it. And as I said, I was a student a few months earlier, living on a small grant subsidised by the government, you know, to go to college. My brother was at school, and Pete, the bass player, had just an ordinary little job. So we were suddenly thrust into the spotlight, you know, on television all the time in the newspapers. And we couldn't go anywhere, you know, because literally it was like lots of screaming girl fans. And I think that if you put people, cage people up like that, I think inevitably they will, something will erupt into violence. And so all that put together ends up with quite a lot of friction.
Well, early on in the band's career, your brother Dave was dragged off the stage by fans and had a big bleeding cut on his head, I think. Did that scare you?
Well, it's what scared me even more. The cut was administered by the drummer.
Oh!
He hit him with a cymbal, which is a cymbal is quite a sharp instrument. But it was, again, from just being living together and this pent-up anger. I think both sides were equally to blame. I didn't actually see what happened, but I looked over and saw the drum kit fall to the ground and Dave on the floor with blood coming out of his skull, whatever. It was quite scary, and I thought the band was over then. They'd never get together again, but they did eventually, and it was still a success.
Ray Davies has a new autobiography called X-Ray. He'll be back with us in the second half of our show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Ray Davies, the lead singer and songwriter of the British band The Kinks. He's just written his autobiography called X-Ray. The Kinks' early records, like Tired of Waiting for You and All Day and All of the Night, were hits during the British invasion era. Before we talk some more, let's hear one of their records from the mid-60s. This is Set Me Free.
I don't need nobody else. So if I can't have you to myself, set me free. Set me free. Oh, set me free, little girl.
Well, early on in your musical career, you got married.
Yeah.
And your wife had a baby.
Yep.
And you write, as I sat with my pregnant wife in our flat, I thought about how I was supposed to be this rebellious pop singer. So was your life really different than you figured your fans thought your life must be?
Well, I was living in a bedsit. We were on our third big hit. Tired of Waiting had gone to number one in England.
Mm-hmm.
And we were just about to embark on a world tour. And I'd just got married and my wife was expecting a child. And so, I was 19 and I think she was about 17. So it was an awesome responsibility suddenly, you know, realising you had to maintain these people who, you know, are with you now. So it's the double standard, 1 minute being on stage, being confronted with all this violence and or energy, let's call it energy, positive energy, and people screaming and singing songs, and then coming home and into a very tranquil, soft, quiet atmosphere. It was quite a shock to the system.
Now, what was it like for you when the band caught on in the States? Maybe you could tell us about your first American tour.
Our first American tour was an absolute catastrophe because we were unprepared for it. I was just after my wife had our first child, a daughter, Louisa, and I left the country, I think, when she was a week old. So we were living in this tiny bed. A bedsit is like an apartment. It's got a bedroom, I suppose, and a little living room on the side. So I felt bad about leaving her. So we went on this tour. I was really emotionally unready for, I was unprepared for it. And Dave and Mick had just gone through this incident where, you know, they'd had this fight on stage and David had these 9 stitches in his head and had the cymbal thrown at him. So it was a disaster waiting to happen, really, or a tragedy waiting to happen. And we just didn't get along. It was just a series of really unlucky events. And eventually it culminated in a lawsuit so much as a ban by, again, I don't really know, promoters or the union or whatever. Sometimes it's best to leave it alone. And they did, and we couldn't come back for 4 years.
Now, how did that affect you professionally?
Oh, I think we lost a lot of so-called revenue, money, from not doing tours. But I kept making records, and the records, I think, were hits here, and they did well here. But I think the sad thing was it was difficult for the audience here to keep up with us, because on our first tour here, we were still playing the heavy rock songs, mm-hmm. like You Really Got Me. But the years I didn't tour here, I developed this sort of, I suppose, laid-back style, Sunny Afternoon, Well Respected Man, all those songs, and Waterloo Sunset. And I suppose it... and not having videos to promote us, so they couldn't see us. It must have been difficult for our fans to actually keep up with what we were doing, because we could tour in England and everywhere else, but we only had the records here.
I mean, when you got back after the American tour, I guess that's about the time that your music changed from, you know, the more rock and roll oriented style to a more almost like social satire.
Yeah,
You know, songs about people living in the suburbs, songs that commented on, you know, the social mores of the time.
Yeah, well, I realised I was on this, as I said, a journey, this wonderful journey that started with You Really Got Me and Tired of Waiting. And now I could really get and write about people I knew about. Because You Really Got Me was about this frustrated, well, this tormented teenager, you know, who just wanted, I suppose it was a girlfriend for the sake of it, you know, just take a girl out after a dance, you know, go out together in the car, whatever. But now I could write about people I'd known when I was growing up and still, you know, I was still learning about people. So I found that really an interesting period to write about. Songs like Dedicated Follower of Fashion, songs like Autumn Almanac, which was really was about a man, a little hunchback man who used to live near me, who was a gardener, and he used to walk around the streets and the kids used to be scared of him, and because, you know, he was an oddity. And I've always, in a sense, been drawn to people like that, odd people who are like, not outcasts from society, but don't walk the straight line again, you know, the kinks of society, I guess.
When you started writing these songs about characters, you know, that were like social criticism, often in suburban settings, some people started criticizing you for it because they thought you'd gotten too suburban. How did you react to that?
I punched them on the nose. You know, I made no bones about it. You know, I grew up in a suburb of North London, a wonderful place called Muswell Hill, which is near one of the most beautiful places. Obviously, I think it was beautiful. Highgate and Parliament Hill Fields, which are London, you know, it has all these parks in it, and Highgate, Finchley, Muswell Hill. They all have these wonderful historical, they've got lots of history there. And it's the land of William Blake, it's the land of Charles Dickens, and there was so much history there. And it was a suburb, but in a sense they were suburbanites. Although I just found out recently that William Blake only left London once. But it's part of this huge, huge, wonderful, mystical place, London. And I think because I was born in the suburbs and, well, only 6 miles from the centre, but it had more of a spirit to it, because I imagined much more going on there than if I'd actually lived in Soho. I imagined the heart of the city where I grew up, rather than actually seeing it every day and taking it for granted. I could be romantic about Waterloo. I could walk, you know, when I went down there and walked around the streets in London, I was sort of immersed in this, you know, history, and I appreciated it more because I was a suburbanite. Didn't bother me one bit.
Well, why don't we hear your song Waterloo Sunset?
Sure.
Say something about the background of this song.
Well, I was Actually, forgot to put it in my book. I was really seriously ill once, and I had to go to a hospital by the Thames. And I think I came out of... I forget what I had. I had fractured something. And I had a... Anyway, illness. And when I got better, they walked me out onto the balcony, and it was overlooking Waterloo with the river. And the river was very high that day. It was like blood pumping through a huge artery in the city. And Waterloo became important to me because it's a focal point in lots of things that happened since in my life. I find that when I'm there, I really feel that I'm at the center of myself, because myself is my work. And like any person, we're all a subtotal, sum total of various parts. But the river in London just, it's the heart of me as well. And maybe it's over romantic to say that, but I genuinely feel a place there for me. But I like any city that's got a river in it. It's just, it seems right.
Well, this is Waterloo Sunset.
Okay.
Dirty old river, must you keep rolling, rolling into the night? People so busy, make me feel dizzy, taxi light shines so bright. But I don't need no friend. As long as I gaze on Waterloo sunset, I am in paradise. Every day I look at the world from my window. Chilly, chilly.
My guest is Ray Davies. He's written a new autobiography called X-Ray. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Ray Davies of the Kinks. Back in that period when people thought you were perhaps getting too suburban, I think it was your management who sent Mort Schumann to work with you. Mm. And Mort Schumann had written songs for Elvis. Did he write Viva Las Vegas with Doc Thomas?
I think he may have done that, yeah.
He wrote some songs for Dion, lyrics, and... What did you try to collaborate with him for a while?
No, Mort came up, as you said, in my book I talk about the time I'd written a few hits, but they were thought that I might become too suburban. So he sent this wonderfully exotic, extravagant, I think it was a New Yorker, up to my house. But by then he was living in Europe. And I suppose to lead me into sort of bad ways again. Maybe I was becoming too good as a person. And he sat with me, and Mort just felt there was part of me. He felt that there was part of me that was a wandering person, a spirit, you know, that needed to be free. And I was being a bit too confined, living in this part of London where I grew up. And I understood what he was trying to say, but I think the die was cast by that time. And as I said, I was on this journey, and I appreciated the fact that he wanted to corrupt me a bit. I really did appreciate that. Thank you, Mort. Dear Mort passed away a year or so ago. But I loved his songs. He Save the Last Dance for me is one of my favourite songs.
Oh, yeah.
And I always feel close to him and in a strange way, because... He wanted the wrong things for me. But I understand why he wanted that. But I think all he wanted to say is you've got to live a bit more and find more, draw on more experiences outside from the ones you've known all your life. That's all he was trying to say, really.
Well, did you find yourself reading different literature or listening to different music when you started writing different kinds of songs?
What I found when, that period, there were lots of people knocking on my door, like, pretending to want to be my friends, who just wanted to know what the trick was.
What do you mean the trick?
The trick of writing songs that everybody liked.
Oh.
and they got really upset when they couldn't. It's like going to find the formula, you know, of an eccentric scientist somewhere. Once you got the formula, you get out. But they couldn't find the formula. because I think my formula was really simple. I just wrote about these events and people and things I loved.
Well, you must have really confused people, though, because very, very few songwriters at that time were writing about characters. Songs were expected to be kind of autobiographical. Mm. Like Randy Newman has confused a lot of people by writing songs, often about very unlikable characters. So I figure the song that confused the people the most probably was Lola, which is about somebody who picks up someone who he thinks is a woman and turns out to be a man.
Mm.
So did that song confuse a lot of people? And maybe you could tell us the story behind writing it.
Although I don't really touch on it in my book, Lola was a song really about not so much confused identity, but more being protective of my own emotions. I draw on lots of different characters when I write a song. I don't really, and it's very rare I write about one thing. And the fact that Lola was a transvestite is incidental. It was really a love song, and all it says really is that I'm in love with somebody, or that the singer is in love with somebody who may not be everybody's taste or whatever, but he's made that commitment. That's all it's about, really, and the rest is just dressing. Mm-hmm. Or cross-dressing.
Yeah. I like that. Yeah. So was it based on someone who you knew or an incident that happened?
Oh, no, it was based on an actual incident, that part of it, in Paris. We used to go to this wonderful club called the Castel. It was a bit seedy. It was in Paris. But at the time, everybody went there. The Stones used to go there, and a lot of actresses and a lot of models and people. And we used to go down there and dance all night and come out the next morning and go to work and not worry about a thing, and or not notice anything. And one night my manager was there and he was dancing away, and Robert was a lovely guy. He was a stockbroker, really should have stayed a stockbroker. And he was 6'6", tall and very thin, typical English, you know, Terry Thomas, a gent. He said, "Oh, Ray, I think I've got on to something here, old boy." I said, "What? See that beautiful girl over there? I'm going to take her out. I think I'd go home with her." And then it was okay until he got into the daylight and realized this girl had lots of stubble on her face, you know, it was a guy. But she was really, really attractive to look at until you get in the daylight. So that I used that story, that had occurred some years before I wrote Lola. So I used that and adapted that and put that in as kind of a subplot in the song. But then it ended up being the main focal point of the song, really. But as I said, the song is really about a love song. It's a love thing. Maybe a love that people shouldn't know about.
Well, let's hear Lola.
I met her in the club down in Old Soho, where you drink champagne and it tastes just like cherry cola. C-O-L-A cola. She walked up to me and she asked me to dance. I asked her her name and in a dark brown voice she said Lola. L-O-L-A, Lola. Lola, Lola, Lola. Well, I'm not the world's most physical guy, but when she squeezed me tight she nearly broke my spine.
That's The Kinks, and my guest is Ray Davies. Well, we're running out of time, I hate to say it, and it looks like we will end in the part of your life where your autobiography ends, which is in about 1973. Why did you choose to end your book there, and what happened? Why was that year a turning point in your own life?
I think a good time to end that is because I died that year.
In your book?
No, I think part a person... I got rid of that shell, really.
Uh-huh.
And
you mean you became somebody else?
It's the end of a song cycle.
Uh-huh.
It's all those lovely songs, I guess innocent the innocent bystander looking on at the world and writing about these characters, good and bad characters, that period ended. And I was on another part of a journey, I guess. It's no trick to it. And so, in a sense, something does die. But in my book, and I won't give away the story in the book, but it goes into that in some depth. And as I say, the subplot is not there just for dressing. It's all adding to what I think is the truth.
Well, I hope that I have the opportunity to talk with you again sometime and pick up the story from there.
Okay, Terry, thank you.
Ray Davies of the Kinks. He has a new autobiography called X-Ray. He's wrapping up a 2-week American tour. He performs tonight in Philadelphia, Thursday in New York, and Sunday in New Haven. This is Fresh Air.